Text on screen, Netflix presents. A Woodshed Films production. A light gray corrugated sheet roof comes into view under the pale sky. Sign above the entrance to the building says, Chouinard Equipment Company. Ivan Chouinard, in his 70s, is at work in the forge.
It all started in my old forge in Ventura, California in the early 60s. It was a crude little shop, but we were making the world's best climbing equipment. You know, we were making stuff for ourselves, number one, and we happened to be on the kind of the cutting edge of climbing at the time.
Chouinard hand forges climbing gear.
None of us wanted to be businessmen, that's for sure. Had to do something just to support our climbing habits and surfing habits.
A group photo.
I hired kind of dirtbag friends who were climbers and surfers and stuff. And
vintage surfboard.
Every time the surf come up, we'd all abandon the shop and go surfing.
Archival footage of younger Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia Clothing, and Doug Tompkins, the founder of North Face.
One day in 1968, my friend Doug Tompkins said, hey, let's go down to Patagonia and go climb Mount Fitzroy. And picked up a 16mm Bolex camera to record the trip. Loaded the car up with surfboards and climbing gear and took off for a 10,000-mile trip down south.
I think from the time we decided to go, it was like 2 weeks before we went. We bought this old van and took off from Ventura. 1968, you gotta remember the Pan American Highway was pretty wild. It was dirt road from Mexico City all the way south.
Chouinard and Tompkins' van races through the desert. A montage of home videos. Young Chouinard surfing, the two climb Mount Fitzroy in the snow, four men climb out of the van in the middle of nowhere.
It was like being in Montana, Wyoming 100 years ago. Here we're in an area that's the size of the whole American West. With no people.
Free roaming horses run. Doug Tompkins in Patagonia.
For those of us that grew up going out into the wilds of the world, where nature was basically untouched, we got into our souls a sense of beauty.
Late sun shines through the peaks in the southern Patagonia ice field.
That trip had a big influence on both Doug and I. It kind of set the course for what we're going to do later in life.
Climbers walk, linked together by a safety rope.
For me, it was the best trip of my life.
Younger Chouinard and Tompkins, beards, hats and scarves, laugh with each other. Fade to black. Title, 180 degrees south. Animated sketch of Chouinard and Tompkins' van rolls across white block letters on black. A beat-up old green truck dashes down the road. In passenger seat, an adventurer looks through a car window.
Here's tonight.
10 years ago, I found that old footage of Doug and Yvonne's trip to Patagonia back in 1968. It was like seeing everything I'd ever wanted to do in my life. From that point on, I promised myself that someday I'd find a way to do a trip like theirs. Years went by before I finally got my chance. I heard about a boat docked down in Mexico that was headed for Patagonia. They needed crew, and I needed a ride south.
Text on screen, Mexico. Day one.
My name is Jeff Johnson. Look in any phone book and you'll find 10 of me. I grew up in Danville, California. You probably never heard of it, but it's a long way from the ocean and the mountains. When I was 8 years old, two things set me on the path that I'm still on. The first one was when my parents took me on a camping trip to Yosemite Valley. I remember looking through a telescope up at this huge granite wall and guys climbing thousands of feet up. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was like watching men walk on the moon.
A baby turtle makes for the ocean.
And that same year, I saw surfing for the first time on TV, Wide World of Sports. I saw these guys riding massive walls of water.
On the seashore, Jeff runs with the surfboard.
There were people out there putting themselves in places they weren't supposed to be.
Jeff rides the waves.
And I knew right then that I wanted to be there too.
Actually was thinking, said everything out loud, 'cause got seats, get awesome that we don't worry about. Sitting sitting on your doorstep waiting for you to come home or come out. Well, apple seeds have sour and we don't care about, so here's for now.
He's inside the big blue curl of the wave.
Here's to now.
Most of my life, I've figured out ways to pick up and leave as the seasons change. I've been a dishwasher, a lifeguard, a flight attendant, whatever it took to pay for the next trip. In the last couple years, though, I found a real job. I've started planting some roots. I've spent a lot less time on the road. But I never forgot about my dream of seeing Patagonia with my own eyes.
Jeff climbs a vertical cliff over the ocean.
Sure, I could take my 2 weeks vacation time and just fly down to Patagonia. But I'll never get a chance like this one again.
He carries his gear from the car to the boat.
If I don't get on that boat, I know exactly what I'm going home to. If I do, my future is unwritten.
Wind sweeps across a vast expanse of coastline.
I'm drawn to open country. It's where everything becomes clear, where the world makes the most sense. When I put myself out there, I always return with something new.
Jeff takes a photo of the horizon.
A friend once told me, the best journeys answer questions that in the beginning, you didn't even think to ask.
Jeff's on board a sailboat. Text on screen, 280 miles off the coast of Central America, day 15. The boat bobs on tall waves, splashing water on the board and crew. Jeff winds the rope with cable winch, climbs a mast, peels potatoes. Jeff hoists a sail. Clouds catch the last golden rays of the setting sun. Jeff does push-ups on the prow. A cattle egret watches Jeff, on his knees, scrubbing the deck with a brush.
I met Yvonne for the first time in the South Pacific a few years ago. I told him about finding that old footage of his and wanting to get to Patagonia myself.
Jeff is the real thing. He's just total dirtbag. He can live out of his car climbing in the valley. He's become a really good climber. Rides any kind of ways.
He's just kind of hustling his way along so he could stay on the road. He reminded me a lot about how I used to be. I met a lot of young people who asked me what books to read or films to watch. I think it's a good way to start, but there's no substitute for just going.
Jeff nods off, foot in the boat's wheel.
Yvonne gave me a photo Doug had taken, a snapshot of a really remote coastline in Patagonia with a mountain called Corcovado. I've been carrying the photo around ever since, imagining myself on top of the ice-covered peak.
Jeff keeps the photo in his book.
For Yvonne and Doug, the best way to get down there was an old van. For me, it's turned out to be this 54-foot cutter called the Sea.
White hull with painted Mesoamerican bear.
Alan, the captain, grew up in Patagonia, and he's taken his boat home. And me, I'm just lucky enough to hitch a ride. But I've never been on a boat for months at a time, and my sea legs aren't as solid as I thought.
Jeff loses his balance and falls back on the foredeck. The boat heaves up and down. Jeff holds onto the railing. He lies on his back, holding his forehead.
Stuff moving a lot, lots of movement. Kind of like the verge of nausea at all times. I'm at a major low point in my entire life. I haven't slept much. I'm trying to sleep right now. I'm doing great. I could vomit at any second.
Ow.
The boat sways. Jeff slides down on the bed, a bag of snacks drops on his head. Archival footage of the 1968 road adventure trip and ascent on Mount Fitzroy, Chouinard and Tompkins reminisce, sipping Mate.
Taking a trip for 6 months, you get into the rhythm of it. It feels like you can just go on forever doing that. Climbing Everest is the ultimate and the opposite of that, because you get all these high-powered plastic surgeons and CEOs and, you know, they pay $80,000 and they have a Sherpas who put all the ladders in place and 8,000 feet of fixed ropes. And you get to a camp and you don't even have to lay out your sleeping bag. It's already laid out with a little chocolate mint on the top. And the whole purpose of climbing something like Everest is to affect some sort of spiritual and
physical gain, but if you compromise the process, you're an asshole when you start out and you're an asshole when you get back.
On board the Sea Bear. Text on screen, 300 miles from the Galapagos Islands, day 27.
Yvonne and Doug should be in Patagonia when I get there. They said I'd be welcome to a warm blanket and a hot meal on my way to Corcovado. Doug lives there full-time with his wife, Chris, and Yvonne will be down there helping them with a big project they've been working on for almost two decades. Yvonne also told me the ice on Corcovado could be completely melted if I get down there any later than December, and that can make it really difficult to make the summit. Which brings up one minor detail. I've never climbed on ice before. Even if I had, you still need a crew for something like this. And I couldn't think of anyone better than my two friends, Timmy O'Neill and Keith Malloy.
And you can check it by going like this. It's gonna be a little rough, but watch. Yeah. See? See how it works like that?
Yeah.
So if the jugs were to mysteriously disintegrate, you would drop onto your gree and it would stop you instantly.
Yeah.
Timmy has climbed all over the world and put up record-breaking ascents in Yosemite Valley. He's climbed El Capitan in 3.5 hours. Even great climbers can take days. Keith quit the pro surf tour about 6 years ago, and since then, he's devoted himself to discovering new surf spots around the world. He's been chased by grizzlies in Canada and shot at by rebels in the Spice Islands. He's a man of few words, but if there's any surf down there, this guy will
find. A vertical granite monolith rises against clear blue sky.
I thought a good warm-up for Keith would be the North American Wall in El Capitan. Yvonne made the first ascent of this route back in 1964 when it was considered the most difficult rock climb in the world.
Keith at the foot of El Capitan.
It's still no cakewalk, which was interesting because Keith hadn't climbed much at all. Not to mention, the guy's afraid of heights.
Keith and Jeff scramble up a wall, place bolts in the rock, and ascend a rope.
Seven comes to three. Then you rose close. 11, thank the heavens for their elasticity. And as for those who live and die for astronomy.
Keith and Jeff mount portal edges suspended high above the ground. Black and white photographs of climbers in hammocks suspended on a vertical wall. Text on screen, The Black Cave, North American Wall, Yosemite Valley, 1964.
We felt like climbing had no worth to society whatsoever. We didn't want to be part of the military-industrial complex. Life was pretty easy in the 60s. I mean, you could buy an automobile for 15 bucks and live out of your automobile and camp out in Yosemite, and then here were these great walls that hadn't been climbed that were as big and as smooth and as difficult as any walls in the world. The biggest one of all was the North American Wall on El Capitan. My friend Chuck Pratt, Royal Robbins, and Tom Frost and I, we made the first ascent over a period of 10 days.
Black and white photos of Chouinard and other climbers.
The wall overhangs the entire way, and it's questionable whether you could ever get down if you got halfway up and couldn't go any further. It's very similar to the first guys to ride really big waves, like at Waimea. They didn't know whether they could get held down by one of these big waves to where they just die. Fear of the unknown is the greatest fear of all. But we just went for it.
Archival footage of surfers on a great wave. The Sea Bear glides over the waves under an overcast sky. Jeff fixes a rope. The compass points the south direction. Text on screen, 2,000 miles from the coast of Peru, day 40.
Keith and Timmy couldn't make the long Pacific crossing, but hopefully they'll be meeting me down in Patagonia. I have the sunrise watch every morning. It's taken me a month to get into the mindset of long-distance sailing. As each day passes, I feel more detached from my scheduled life back home and more in rhythm with what surrounds me.
A sunset fades to black. Daytime. The mast collapses in the sea.
This morning, during my watch, our 70-foot mast was ripped out and snapped like a twig. We were adrift in the middle of nowhere. Everything was down in the ocean, smashing against the hull. I thought it was obvious that we'd cut everything loose, but Alan had a different plan. He came up on deck with a knife in his hand and announced that everything would be coming back on board.
The captain takes a dive in a mast and swim fins to salvage the remains.
Twelve long hours later, we finally have the broken mast and everything else on board. It turned out a defective piece of rigging was to blame. But it was hard not to feel like I should have seen some early sign of this. Tonight, we are too tired to eat. We don't have enough fuel to get to mainland Chile, so our only option is to motor 400 miles to Rapa Nui, otherwise known as Easter Island.
The word adventure has just gotten overused. For me, adventure is when everything goes wrong. That's when the adventure...
Morning. Jeff watches Rapa Nui in the distance. A montage of Moai statues on the coast. The disheveled sea bear arrives at the shore. A fisherman perched on a porch fixes a soft plastic lure shaped like a squid to a hook.
A month and a half at sea, and we have finally limped in to the most remote island in the world, Rapa Nui.
Text on screen, Rapa Nui, aka Easter Island, day 44. Mounted police patrol the street. Children watch colorful fishing boats bobbing in the port. A woman hauls a tuna. Surfers ride the waves. Fishermen set out to sea.
We'd only planned to be on Rapa Nui for a few days to resupply, but it looks like we're going to be here a lot longer than that. The first person I met is a girl named Makohe. I saw her teaching some kids to surf on the inside of the bay. She was born and raised here, and she's promised to show me around the island. It's nearly December, but for the first time, I'm not as worried about getting to Corcovado before the ice melts.
The Polynesian woman with the yellow flower in her long hair says something to Jeff. From horseback.
Coming to Rapa Nui is like going back to the past. And the people, they have like the history in their blood. My mom, she was used to live in the time when the plane came over the island and dropped something in the ocean. The letters, supplies.
A lot's changed, huh?
Yeah, many things.
Yeah, when we were kids, like the entertainment, it was to watch the plane coming and going. And we'll sit in this like big tree that we had in the corner of my house somewhere, and we'll bring sandwiches and we'll sit and we'll watch the plane come down for the whole time it was there.
That was the entertainment?
Yes.
Everybody watched?
Yeah.
So you're the first woman to surf in Rapa Nui?
When I start surfing, there's only these guys in the water, and I've never seen a woman surfing in the water. And I told my brother, can I go there? Because he had so much fun. He said, no, it's only for men. And then one day I told him, oh, take me there, because I want to see. And I went, and it was fun. And I was the only woman for like a long time, maybe.
Makoa surfs the waves behind a Moai statue.
When I'm in big cities, surrounded by cars or smog, or I just close my eyes and I think about Rapa Nui. The blue sky, the nice people, the ocean, the waves. I just think about that in my mind. And that makes me strong, just having Rapa Nui. I don't want Rapa Nui to change. I want it to be like this.
Jeff on his morning jog alongside horses.
Yeah.
Days have turned into weeks. When the sea is calm, we work on the boat. When it comes to life, I explore the volcanic coastline with Makohe. This island has taken us in like family. You're like a
roller. Standing atop a cliff of consolidated lava, Jeff throws his surfboard into the water and jumps after it.
See, you could make a dead man scream. You're like a roller coaster.
Jeff rides the waves in the same spot as Makohe before.
As the weeks pass, I tell Makohe about my plan to climb Corcovado. Without hesitation, she asks if she can come along. At this point, I wonder if any of us will make it to Patagonia on the boat. But I promise her I'll ask Alan if we can squeeze one more person on board.
The wounded sea bear wallows at anchor offshore. Jeff and Makoa surf.
Because you lift me up so high. It's the most unbelievable ride.
Jeff's head disappears in the white breakers, which roll over him toward the shore. Text on screen, Ahu Tongariki, Rapa Nui, Day 62.
Yvonne had told me about Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, and how Diamond presents Easter Island as a cautionary tale, a grim example of a society that exceeded its resources and suffered the consequences.
When the first Europeans set foot on Easter Island in 17-something, all the Moai were all standing upright. But as the population increased, the people started separating out into different little tribes, putting all their time and energy into, you know, outdoing each other, making larger and larger moais.
An animation illustrates the tale.
And it became the central focus of the entire society. It took priority over survival almost. And eventually they would cut down their entire forest to transport these giant carved stones. And this became such an obsession that they depleted the island's resources and led to tribal warfare, cannibalism. And eventually the population of the island of 30,000 was finally reduced down to 111 people. I've met Jared Diamond a few times and talked about his book, Collapse, and how all the different societies of the past that he studied that have collapsed, and that, and what does that mean for our society? And in the end, he really says that we're making all the same mistakes that all these other societies have made.
As the story of Easter Island goes, so goes the planet. It's a haunting thought, and I'm beginning to see these statues a little differently. I remember a quote I read one time from Aldous Huxley. It never resonated with me much until now. He wrote, "Men do not learn very much from the lessons of history, and that is the most important of all the lessons of history."
Jeff and another sailor carry a long debarked tree trunk.
There wasn't a harbor on the island big enough to get in to fix our mast, so we have to figure out how to do the repair while anchored offshore.
On board the cutter, repair works are underway, drilling, cutting, board planing.
When the winter rains come pouring down on that new home of mine, will you think of me and wonder if I'm fine?
Alan got a hold of some old plans sailors have used for centuries when forced to remast while at sea. With no proper boat-building equipment, these archaic blueprints are our only option.
They put up the tree trunk as cantilever next to the empty mast step.
It'll be in your eyes and on your mind.
Four men pull at the rigging. One climbs to the top of the cantilever.
No. Journey through the past, and it won't be back till February comes.
bridge is fixed in position, they slowly put up the mast made from salvaged scraps, parallel to the cantilever.
We've spent a month getting ready to hoist our mast, and we've used everything we can get our hands on. Our jury-rigged mast, half the size of the original, weighs over 500 pounds. Stepping it to the deck in a rolling sea could be disastrous. One snap line could set off a chain reaction, bringing everything down, taking us out with it. When the wind eases, we'll take our best shot. If we fail, it'll be the end of my trip.
The mast is successfully put in place. The men high-five each other. The sea bear is partly fixed. Night falls, a lone surfer heads to the shore. Christmas tree lights glow in the dark. Text on screen, Christmas Eve. Day 75.
Almost a month on Rapa Nui. Soon we will pull anchor and start our 2,300-mile crossing to Chile. I've always felt better on the move. As soon as I learned to walk, I was running. Today, though, I wouldn't mind staying here forever.
Jeff and Mako sit on a surfboard, silhouetted against the sea glistening at sunset. Jeff looks at the horizon from the bow of the ship.
It's hard to leave a place I really connect with. I tell myself I'll be back, but I know there's a good chance I never will.
He's in the water, holding onto a ladder.
The good news is, that question I asked Alan about whether or not we had any extra space on the boat, well, we do. And Makohe's coming with me to Corcovado.
Jeff pulls himself up on the ladder and boards the boat, where Mako waits for him. Archival footage of the white 4D series van transporting four surfboards on its roof along the Pacific coast.
You get to the top of a wall, there's nothing up there.
Lionel Terre, the great French climber, called it the conquistadors of the useless. Yeah, the end result is absolutely useless, but every time I travel, I learn something new, and hopefully I get to be a better person.
Young Chouinard scales a snowy slope using an ice axe.
When you've had a whole life in the outdoors, you realize that you have a sense of responsibility to protect these wild places.
Clouds float above the southern Patagonian ice field. On board the Sea Bear motor sailing toward continental Chile, Makoa and Jeff watch the shore. Text on screen, Algarabo, Chile, day 101.
After a 16-day crossing from Rapa Nui, we finally arrive in Chile. This marks the end of Alan's 10,000-mile voyage from Seattle. After years of being gone, it's good to see he's made it home.
Jeff and Alan disembark. They hug. A series of images of Algarabo show fishermen busy at work, seagulls over a white cross on top of a cliff and colorful boats in the harbor. A shadow of a car rolling down a mountain road on a sunny day.
The Sea Bear will be months in port waiting for a new mast, so Makohe and I decide to keep moving south.
Jeff watches the road through a window of a coach.
Makohe has a friend from Pichilemu, a town south of here. He's a big wave rider named Ramon Navarro, and his roots here go back generations. She thinks he'll have a place for us to stay, and since his dad is a fisherman, he might have ideas in finding us another boat to Corcovado.
And my mom say my grandpa, he traded the land for one horse.
Right in here?
Yeah, all where my house it is and all around, 50 acres, maybe more, for one horse. My whole family come from here. So I have my roots in here, and I see a lot around the world what happened, where the people coming with money and change everything. We don't want to change the best and the more beautiful place we have in here. We're gonna fight for that, man.
The waves beat against a lonely rock. Ramon Navarro runs down the cliff with a surfboard. He rides the waves.
Wouldn't you like to be out on the rolling sea, with only the sky above you for a roof. What if your friends were there, laugh at all your jokes and share sweet salt air with you? Wouldn't that be good?
Makoa sits on her surfboard. The top of the rock is occupied by a nesting colony of seabirds. Makoa gives a show of dexterity on her surfboard against all waves.
Wouldn't you like to find yourself there sometime? Ducking when the bow swings your way. Whenever we make plans.
Getting good surf when I travel has always come secondary to the experience of just being on the road. But on our second day, we woke up to a big, perfect swell and no one in the water. The last wave I rode that day turned out to be the longest wave of my life. I'll never forget it.
Jeff surfs rail to rail. Rolling waves break in stable pattern. Jeff twists and turns, chased by the white foamy wave. Back in the house, Ramon works a corkscrew. Two bottles of red and several glasses are on the table. Ramon's father pulls up a chair for Jeff.
Gracias.
Ramon's parents watched the ocean change when big commercial fishing companies arrived and destroyed the local fisheries. His father taught him to work hard, live simply, and have a deep respect for the ocean.
Mr. Navarro puts empanadas into a clay baking oven, shows Makoa his fishing nets. Later he goes to cast his nets underwater, in a diving suit and snorkel. He pulls out his net. He and Ramon go through the catch. Subtitle, you see, the ocean and then the land are of course the most important providers there could be. You should know something about working the land because the land will give back to you. We don't really work the land for money, but at least it provides for our own kitchen table. Mr. Navarro plows the field with a horse. I've learned from my experience working in the ocean, which I teach my friends. You must have respect for the ocean. For us, industrial fishing shouldn't exist. Commercial fishing fleets are our enemies. They started coming closer and closer to shore, and now the schools of fish are gone. Before, the mackerel came right up to the beach. Now we have to buy them at the store.
Ramon tells me that today, the biggest threat they face are the pulp mills popping up along the Chilean coast.
Fighting against the cellulose mills is like fighting with a giant. The mill, with smoking chimneys, overlooks the shore. The government and the corporations never told us anything about how their big project was going to contaminate the marine area, with cellulose waste pumped into the ocean. Up until the 1950s, Constitución was one of the most culturally rich resort towns in Chile. When the pulp mill opened, it just killed everything. It killed the fishing, the town. It killed the soul of the town. It's sad because a big part of Chile is now contaminated. A view of the coastal area occupied by the industrial plant. Now in southern Chile, to make matters worse, they want to build 6 hydroelectric dams. All of the people who have invested their lives and respect these things, like the artisan fisherman who's fished his whole life, then one day to the next, a tremendous dam is built. And suddenly, his livelihood is gone. and he has to escape from all the smoke, stench, water pollution and chemical residues. The people have job security with this industry, but at what price? A tiny fishing boat comes to harbor among great commercial fishing vessels. The men go spearfishing underwater. Ramon and his dad examine what they've caught. Two fish and a crab lay next to a patched up pair of swim fins on a slab of rock. They carry it back to the fishing shack. Text on screen, San Diego, day 113.
Here I am in the city after 3 months at sea.
People and cars move in fast motion.
This place has more people than Los Angeles. Right now, they're building a 3 million square foot shopping mall and an office tower that will be the tallest building on the continent. I find myself thinking about the collapse of Rapa Nui. Growth is inevitable, but can we maintain this momentum in the long term?
A man skateboards.
Being here reminds me of my life back home, and I'm beginning to think about my own use of resources.
The same skateboarder with a black backpack speeds up down an empty street.
Yvonne told me before I left that if we come through Santiago, we should visit his friend Juan Pablo Orrego. He's made it his life's work to stop urban sprawl in wild Chile and is fighting for the fading way of life of its indigenous people.
Juan Pablo Orrego, how can people who are trapped in the city try to create a more ecologically minded world if you don't know that it's possible? A good example of how people become closed off from their ecosystems is with their Walkman or iPods. So you start to further close yourself off. You don't want to breathe the dirty air. You don't want to hear, because it's annoying. You don't want to look, because it's ugly. That's why we don't understand nature, love it or take care of it. We don't realize that we depend on it. Psychologically and physically, 100%. Two oxen pull a farmer's cart. A man rides a horse down a village street. Early in the morning, Jeff comes home with groceries, pats a dog's head.
My old friend Keith Malloy has finally caught up with me. During our climb last year on El Capitan, he tore up his knee pretty bad and had to get surgery. On the mend, just before this trip, he caught one of the biggest waves of his life at Mavericks.
A photograph shows Keith surfing a wave the size of a five-story building.
I thought Timmy would be with him, but he's off climbing somewhere. So I hope he shows up before we get to Corcovado.
A small vessel motorsails south from the coast of mainland Chile.
We've come to a point where the road ends and the land begins to break apart. So we found a local boat to take us on the last leg to Patagonia.
The boat under a tiny Chilean flag carries three passengers. Two dolphins accompany it.
What I see here is a realization of a dream 40 years in the making.
Young Chouinard on a similar boat.
It all started with that trip Doug and Yvonne took here in 1968. This is Conservación Patagónica, and it stretches as far as the eye can see.
Text on screen, Conservación Patagónica, Land Trust, day 124. Jeff, Makoa and Keith disembark and wade through shallow water with their bags. Snowy summits tower over the bay. A bridge leads to a building. The screen fades to black. Early morning. Two people paddle with their arms on surfboards. A pod of dolphins arch their backs over the surface of water behind them.
All my friends are getting older. I guess I must be too. Without their loving kind.
A raft of sea lions stick their heads out playfully.
Know what I'll do. Oh, the wine bottles half.
Jeff and Keith paddle right beside them.
The money's all been spent. We're across between our parents and hippies in a tent. Love calls just like wild birds. Well, it's another.
They swim under a steep rocky cliff overgrown by lush vegetation. Doug and a dark-haired woman come down to meet them.
For the last 18 years, Doug and his wife Chris, along with Yvonne, have dedicated their lives to one of the largest private land conservation projects in the world, Conservación Patagónica. In the early 90s, Doug and Chris began raising money and using their own life savings to acquire large tracts of wild lands in Chile and Argentina. With the help of hundreds of passionate workers and volunteers, they've succeeded in protecting entire ecosystems and fostering sustainable farming and ranching programs. Added together, the amount of land they put into conservation is bigger than Yellowstone National Park.
An aerial view of the great wilderness areas, forests, waterfalls, and high peaks. A complex of four wooden cabins surrounded by a wattle fence.
I've arrived over a month late, but Yvonne and Doug are still here. I'd heard about their project, but I had no idea just how big it was. I've always thought of their trip here 40 years ago as an adventure, but now I realize it was a turning point.
We didn't change our lives overnight, but it had a big influence on me. For me, it was the best trip of my life. The whole history of Latin America is conquistadores. It's not much different from the States, but in the States, at least, we don't trust the government, and so we have a history of philanthropy. So Doug comes down here, and he says, I'm going to create a national park, and I'm going to give it back to you Chileans. And they're going, give me a break. People don't do that. You know, there has to be another reason.
I think first and foremost, people only protect those things they love. And you can't love something unless you inherently identify.
Chris Tompkins.
That's certainly one of the reasons we ended up here. We have over 2 million acres of land put into conservation. And people think that's a lot of land, but really we're on the losing team here.
Juan Pablo Orrego. Doug is a deep ecologist, there's no doubt. What Doug has done in Chile by creating national parks. He has put a topic on the table that wasn't previously out there in Chile, which is the topic of conservation of nature. And really the relationship between the conservation and the development of a country. The politics surrounding the argument and the reason Doug has adversaries and critics is because he is shifting the paradigm. Doug Tompkins.
First of all, you never know if you're doing the right thing. You gotta temper all your thinking that way. But the way I see it, with land conservation, say of this type, is that the risk of something negative coming from this seems to be rather small compared with taking a exploitive approach. If we make some errors, they're going to be rather small, because I'm sure we're making errors. The thing is to minimize those errors. I think it leaves open possibilities for future generations. It doesn't seem to be worth wasting a lot of energy on attempting to rewrite the past. I just realized that at least what I was doing was making a lot of stuff that nobody needed and pushing a consumerist society. So I went to do something else.
Ivan Schwinard.
We're really, really different. We have the same viewpoint of the world and where it's going. Different approach to it. He's more bothered probably about the end of society and mankind and stuff than I am, because he wants to do something about it. And I'm just kind of a laid-back Zen Buddhist and just say, wow, you know, I'll do what I can, and so be it.
Well, I tell my buddy Yvonne that good Buddhist has to take his bodhisattva vows, which means that before self-enlightenment, one has to end the suffering in the world.
Ivan adds hot water to his yerba mate cup. Smoke comes out the chimney of Doug's wood cabin. Sheep graze outside. Blue, yellow, and red beehives gleam in the sun. Doug runs his fingers across a honeycomb. Makoa.
I never knew about Douglas before, and many people told me like he was a bad man because he bought all this land from Chile and he's taking all the land for him. That's what people said, like now, because they don't know him. They don't know what he's doing. And for me to get to see that, he's an example that many people should follow. The solution, I think it's in all of us. And I learned that in the South with Douglas. In a way, I saw the future of Rapa Nui too.
Here we're germinating from seeds, mm-hmm. and different species. First of all, we're just doing general restoration work and reforestation. Here we have Alerce. They're from Lago Negro. See, they have in different places. Since you can't find these species in regular nurseries in any numbers, we realized that we had to start our own tree nursery.
Doug shows Makoa around.
Blink long enough, now you're sleeping. Blink hard enough, blink long enough, now you're sleeping.
They look up at an enormous tree split through the middle. Chris Tompkins.
During the Pinochet era, Chile awarded the rights, the water rights, to the majority of their rivers to private enterprise, something that you would find in almost no other country. And the result of that is the Spanish energy company, Endesa, they have been rather methodically going through and establishing energy projects in the form of dams on rivers throughout Chile.
Jeff walks along a great dam.
I saw what Chris was talking about up north on the Biobío River. This was once a fully functioning ecosystem where the river, forest, and people depended on one another. Juan Pablo says these dam projects are a symptom, but he also says the true cause of the problem is the development model. I'm thinking of those looming high-rises in Santiago, all lit up. I'm thinking of Ramon and his talk about the price tag of progress. I read that the American video game habit annually consumes as much power as the entire city of San Diego. So I'm also thinking about all those little things that add up to keep us comfortable or just amused. And I'm beginning to see the real consequences.
The illuminated city of San Diego in fast motion. Jeff walks down to the harbor where a boat arrives.
Better late than never. Timmy O'Neill always comes through, and today, 2 days before we set off to Corcovado, he's arrived fresh from another long stint of ice climbing and running rivers.
A photograph in Tim O'Neill ice climbing. Tim gets off the boat, Jeff and Doug greet him. Rain falls on a stone statue of a woman holding out her hands. Inside the cabin, the team lean over a map.
All in here. You know, there are big, long beaches and so forth. I'd say not as much up in here. And especially there is where you get this exposed. Yeah. And there's kind of the open ocean out of there, and you get these swells that are kind of unimpeded that are coming in there, and they hit right in this area here. And if you got the boat, you can, depending on what kind of weather it is, hopefully you get some kind of storm. You get some storm swells.
You ever been in this area in here?
Yeah, you want to just trek along here, and you'll go comparatively fast up the gully, and then you'll get slowed down as it starts into the thing. And this gets up to about...
Doug is the only person who's ever stood on top of Corcovado. In the early 90s, he and a friend set out to do the first ascent. It took him 3 long days just to get to the base. When they reached the top of the glacier below the steep summit pitches, his climbing partner decided to turn back. So Doug climbed the rest of it alone, soloing the last few hundred feet of technical ice without a rope.
Ivan Schwinard.
I must say, that's pretty wild what he did. You know, you got to think about not only getting up, but you got to think about getting down. There's no anchors to rappel or anything like that. He had to down climb a lot of that. That was a great climb. It's never been repeated.
drifting clouds reflected in the window at sunrise. Jeff brings firewood. Later he and Ivan collect mussels on the shore, which they cook over the fire.
Lay me down. Lay me down. I've got blisters on my feet. Blisters almost everything I need to move.
I love this old son of a bitch.
Keith Malloy grins at Ivan cutting out a mussel with the tip of his knife. Ivan drinks the juice and puts the mollusk in his mouth.
You know where I want to be right now? It's right here. Nowhere else, not in the future, not in the past.
Look at that. Look at that fat guy.
Oh my God.
Oh.
Don't lose the juice.
Oh man.
Oh. This is what I've worked for all my life. I'm gonna be 70 next November, and it's a good life, though, I tell you, no regrets. I just live for the moment.
Early morning, Jeff and Keith carry their gear to the boat.
We're making our final passage to Corcovado. And this morning, Yvonne surprised us all by hopping on the boat. He's been a climber for over 50 years. He just couldn't help it. Who knows? This could be his last big climb.
They set out in the boat and organize their climbing gear as they make way further south.
We're 2 days out and the clouds have finally lifted from the mountain. After 5 months of travel, I'm finally here.
Text on screen, Corcovado, day 132.
It's hard for me to believe that in only a few days we'll be up there, standing on the summit.
The top of the conical volcano emerges from the clouds like the dorsal fin of a shark. Down by the river, it's a calm spring day.
I think you're gonna like climbing.
Have you climbed with women before?
Oh, they're great climbers.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
But do you think I'll be a good climber?
Yeah.
Ivan gives Makoa some tips.
So you always want the ice axe on the uphill.
This is a position of balance, okay? This is out of balance because it's easy to fall over, right?
Keith has figured out that the Corcovado coast is more sheltered from swell than we had originally thought. Turns out this place needs a really specific swell direction from the south. But Keith got a report of some movement off Cape Horn, so he's opted to stay back and scour the coast for waves while the rest of us head up the river.
Ivan, Jeff, Makoa, and Tim carry their backpacks across a mountain stream. Ivan walks over a tree trunk fallen over the water. Makoa and the boys walk through the water.
It isn't anything that
Keith motorsails around the volcano.
Oh, gotta see, gotta know right now. What's that riding on your shadow?
A close-up on a Cantaria beetle covered in droplets of mist. The climbers carry their backpacks over their heads, wading up to their waists in a river.
Caring for it at all. Not the gravity plan.
Jeff catches fish. Makoa dries her shoes by the fire.
Now that we've followed the river to its source, we have to cross the forest along four glacial lakes until we have a clear shot at the summit from the northeast side.
It all will fall right into the sea.
The foot of the volcano is overgrown by thick bush. The climbers struggle to get through it. They move up inch by inch, holding onto the branches. The upper limit of the vegetation is nowhere near.
We really underestimated this thing. I think higher was the call. Well, I think even just a little higher, you get more valleys, but you get less jungle. It gets thicker as you get towards the river, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I would even think about going back.
Oh, God.
Mileage, I don't know. Maybe 3 miles, but hours, seemingly endless.
This is the worst. This isn't climbing. This is. But, you know, you could take a helicopter right to the snow line and climb it, because that's cheating. I guess this is what makes the climb, this crap.
Makoa tries to find a spot to put her foot among the shrubs.
We have rock hopped and bushwhacked 10 hours a day for the last few days. Sometimes we've been forced to backtrack and start all over again.
They hike past a glacial lake reflecting the snow-capped top of Corcovado.
We've been in this section of the new park for 3 days now. I've spent a lot of time in places I thought were wild, but I've never seen anything like this.
This is probably the craziest part of Chile that I've seen so far, I think. I don't think very many humans have been up here.
Makoa enjoys a soak in the lake. She could be mistaken for a seal as she dives in and emerges from the water. La, 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 la. The triangular peak of the volcano towers over the lake. Jeff joins Makoa. La, 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 la. They set up camp among some standing but dead trees and study the possible route to the top. La, la, la.
I think we can do this whole thing on this ridge and not even touch snow.
On the ridge to the left of us.
That we're looking at, yeah.
Moving on snow will be easier than moving on really loose debris.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, safer, essentially. But the problem is if you fall on snow, you slip down.
You could die.
And die.
I know, snow kind of scares me a little bit.
Have you done much on it?
I've done none.
Zero?
Zero.
Why am I finding this out now?
I've told you this a long time ago.
A long time ago? That was a long time ago. I forget. It's like Makoe has an excuse. She's from Rapa Nui. It's a really remote island in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah, what's my
excuse? Your excuse is just ignorance, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's not an excuse,
Jeff. But
I've
told you of my ignorance, so you're not ignorant of my ignorance.
That doesn't absolve you of it, though, dude. That only makes me knowledgeable of your ignorance. What I'm saying, Jeff, is that this is serious.
Timmy stares at Jeff and back at the volcano, with its northern slope covered by snow. Fade to black. They start their ascent in the dark.
We got to camp last night around dark and woke up at 2 a.m. to push for the summit. Now, after months, years really, I'm finally approaching my goal.
Do you still sing of the mountain bed we made of limbs and leaves? Do you still sigh there near
the... Their headlamps shed weak lights. The four climbers are silhouetted against dark blue sky before sunrise.
You laughed as I covered you over with leaves, fist, breast, hips, and thighs. You smiled and I said the leaves were just the color of your eyes.
Timmy leads the way. Jeff, Makoa, and Ivan follow in his footsteps. It gets warm enough for them to take off their hats.
Keith is somewhere below us searching the Corcovado coast for surf. From up here, I see fresh swell on the horizon. Even if the surf is small, I know he's finding what he came down here for. Solitude.
Keith surfs a swell. Later he carries his surfboard under his arm.
doesn't smell.
Beyond, the summit of Corcovado rises above a thick green zone of vegetation and clouds hovering above it.
With a taste of twigs we chewed, rectangle advanced twine. Trees held us in an awful.
The climbers make their way through the ice field, using ice axes in the cane position.
I cannot see any wrong in you, and you saw none in me.
They dig their crampons in the snow with every step. They stop on the verge of a precipice and look down.
Ground against the ground, your cheeks part of the sky. Your fingers play with grassy moss as the
Meanwhile, Keith glides across ocean waves.
Your shirt and your knees are in the air. Feet play games with mountain roots as you lay thinking there.
He showers under a waterfall.
Below us, the trees grew clumps of trees, raised families of trees, and they, as proud as we, tossed their heads in the wind and plummet.
The ice field gets steeper and firmer. Jeff looks up at the summit. He moves up by digging the spike of his ice axe in the snow and taking two steps up at a time.
Valley below. The people stop.
Tim creates a snow anchor by burying a picket.
Come and go.
The edge of the ice field is near. Further up, the ice has melted away and the brittle volcanic rock is exposed.
At the edge of the ice field, my worries have become a reality. Our delay in Rapa Nui has pushed this climb deeper into the southern hemisphere summer. There's no ice left on the summit, and from here, the rock doesn't look solid. This climb's going to be a lot more dangerous than we thought.
It looks like we have 10 pitches of really rotten rock.
It looks like all the rocks are just going to fall down.
It's going to be a little sketchy.
Yeah. You know, we got to get the team up. And you guys are the fastest, so you guys ought to just go. Go for it. I'm happy.
You sure?
Yeah.
Tim and Jeff come down through the ice field and try another route.
We rope up and prepare to make our move from solid ice to crumbling rock. We are unsafe here at best.
They attempt to climb up another glacier to the top. Jeff steps straight up a steep face for a couple of feet, following a crack until it ends. He traverses toward another crack.
Timmy and I hoped that the rock would get better as we got higher. But 3 hours later, it felt like we were standing on the slanted roof of a high-rise with nothing but marbles under our boots. We were only 200 feet from the top, but we had to face the facts.
I'm not sure if we should continue because it seems literally like the next pitch above me is the worst unconsolidated nightmare I've ever seen. We've climbed about 500 feet of this bullshit, and the worst is right in front of me.
These loose boulders here hold, oh my lord, hold this block, which holds this block, which holds our equipment in the crack.
Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. Rock.
This isn't a good option.
Hey, Jeff! It doesn't seem like it's worth risking my life, but we still have to get down!
The unconquered naked peak of Corcovado rises above all other mountain ranges in sight. A colony of seagulls flies over the ocean, Keith surfs waves glistening gold in the sun. He crouches and rises on the surfboard, constantly keeping balance. Two shadows of climbers coming down a steep slope are cast on the rocky ground. Jeff goes back through the ice field with his head slumped.
I've come all this way, and I've given myself to this trip completely. I pictured myself on top of Corcovado, just like those guys I saw through a telescope in Yosemite Valley when I was a kid. And now I'm backing down, just a couple hundred feet short of the summit.
He walks toward a misty halo across the sky, past some spruce trees on his left. He stops to look at the lake reflecting the mountains around it.
I wouldn't take back anything I experienced along the way. But it's hard to shake it. Those last two pitches that went unclimbed.
Moon rises directly over the peak of Corcovado. Jeff and Keith go surfing, leaving the peak of the volcano bathing in a cloud behind them.
Some grapes and leaves, man, you can never tell.
Jeff and Makoa master the waves along the southern Chile coastline.
When you'll have to change your face and hide your trophies well.
The sun shines, the light on the ocean is sparkly silver, and the hills around them are endless waves of green vegetation.
A mountain going to your home. Village has evacuated, now you gotta roam. Your feet could start to moan, and your eyes don't see too clear. The darkest dreams can come. Shake your veins to steer.
Ivan Chouinard.
When those guys came back, they were pretty shot and pretty discouraged that they couldn't climb it. Any mountain at certain times is safe, and at other times it's super dangerous. We just happened to be there at the wrong time. Maybe Jeff and Tim were still bothered by the idea that they couldn't climb it. So it's kind of like the quest for the Holy Grail. Well, you know, who gives a shit what the Holy Grail is? It's the quest is what's important. The transformation is within yourself. That's what's important.
Jeff drives a red pickup truck, transporting two surfboards on the roof. Ivan is in the passenger seat.
It's been nearly 6 months since I left home to climb Corcovado. But getting shut down doesn't mean my trip is over. The biggest project for Conservación Patagónica is even further south, and that is also where the dams are to be built. But the locals are getting more and more organized in their opposition. They have created a grassroots organization called Sin Represas, which means without dams. We've been seeing their signs and banners everywhere.
A banner in Spanish says, Free Rivers. Text on screen, Casa Piedra. Conservación Patagónica, day 150. The team is back in the cabin.
I'm humbled by this place and inspired by its people. The Gauchos work with Doug as park rangers, and I've asked Yvonne if we could spend our last few days here working with them.
A Gaucho, there are people in Santiago or other cities who don't have the love for Patagonia. We have the love for Patagonia. It is really easy for Chile to have no love for this land.
Entonces realmente, o sea, es muy fácil Chile, o sea, es una tierra sin cariño que tiene el Estado. Pero quién la quiere realmente.
But in reality, we grew up here and we live here.
O sea, y vive de eso, que muchas veces.
A lot of times, Patagonia is a place that they can sell or give as a gift, as they have already done.
Se ha hecho.
The protest started with one gaucho in the little town of Cochrane. He heard about the power company's plan to build these dams. on the Bakker and the Pasquare River. And so he decided to go to the capital and demand the government stop this construction.
Word got out as he passed each farm and ranch, and in just 2 days, hundreds of riders had joined him.
A cavalcade of gauchos ride holding flags and banners. An old villager, I would ask you with all my heart, like a good Chilean, do a little more reflection. We came here doing a sacrifice. I am an old deer, from the mountains. We are related to the deer. Don't forget it. To the youth and the kids, record this in your memory, and take it with a lot of responsibility. Do not remain distant. A gaucho with a loudspeaker, continue fighting to conserve our Patagonia.
4 days later, when they arrived...
A gaucho, I think the dam will be built. The government is pushing for it. It is approved. This is devastating, not necessarily for me, but for the family I leave behind.
Esto es penoso para uno porque realmente no es tanto para mí, la familia que hay atrás.
This is the problem. The gauchos walk their horses back through a dry riverbed. Jeff drags two spare ones carrying large bundles.
This new park used to be a sheep ranch, but the livestock was removed from this section so the wildlife can come back. The gauchos have been taking down the old fences, and we volunteered to help them in their work.
When we started, we had 400 miles of fencing to take down. That's a lot of fencing. Now it's down to less than 300 miles. Hopefully, in a few years, it'll all come down.
Makoa throws a large wooden fence post on a pile. Everyone wears heavy-duty gloves. Ivan dismantles two planks nailed together. Jeff rolls the barbed wire and throws it on a neat stack. Keith helps a gaucho wrap the barbed wire between two wicker wheels and strap it to the saddle. A herd of guanacos observe them from the top of a hill.
Almost immediately, the guanaco and all the other wild animals come back and take over the territory. It's a small but satisfying restoration of the natural order of things.
Ivan and the team sit by the fire at dusk. Makoa plays the guitar and sings.
In a few days, Makohe will head home to her family in Rapa Nui.
Makoa rides the waves on a surfboard.
Timmy will head back to Yosemite.
Timmy climbs a vertical rock.
And Keith will head north to look for surf in Canada.
Keith is in the passenger seat of the red pickup truck rolling across the arid hills.
This journey was like going back in time. Like seeing North America before it became dominated by industry.
Jeff is behind the wheel.
But for these people, it's not some nostalgic trip into the past. It's their pride.
A gaucho grins, Ramon in fisherman's suit.
Their hard work and ability to live simply with the land is proof that we can learn from tradition.
Doug carries a wooden paddle across his shoulder.
These people have shown me that if you love a place, you have a duty to protect it. And to love a place, you must know it first.
Mr. Navarro plows his field. Text on screen, Baker River, day 158. Jeff takes a photo of the canyon behind a barbed wire fence.
This is one of the rivers the gauchos have been trying to protect, and where one of five dams is supposed to go in.
An animation illustrates the planned dam construction.
The plan is to have power flow from here to big cities hundreds of miles away.
The dam is constructed across the river. It creates a reservoir in the valley. A dry area forms on the other side. Roads and transmission towers appear around the valley.
I'm certainly no expert, but those fallen statues in Rapa Nui are seared in my memory, lying face down in the dirt. It's like they're trying to tell us something. I left home 6 months ago to follow in the footsteps of my heroes. A bit of surfing, some climbing, lots of unspoiled terrain. Pretty simple, really. Well, I got all that. But along the way, I've also begun to make connections that I never thought much about. In these far corners of the world, I'm seeing the effects of encroaching progress. And most of this has to do with overconsumption elsewhere. It's easy for us to blindly consume when we don't see the effect it has on other places.
Ivan Schwinard.
The hardest thing in the world is to simplify your life. It's so easy to make it complex. What's important is leading an examined life, because most of the damage caused by humans is caused unintentionally, I think.
In response, to people say you can't go back. So, well, what happens if you get to the cliff and you take one step forward, or you do a 180-degree turn and take one step forward? Which way are you going? Which is progress?
Solution may be for a lot of the world's problems is to turn around and take a forward step. You can't just keep trying to make a flawed system work.
My whole life, I've been drawn to open country. I always return home a little different. But I know now we can no longer take it for granted. When open country is gone, we will be gone with it.
The view of snow-covered mountain peaks under the blue sky fades to black. Hues of gray and blue light up the ridges of vast Patagonia Wildlife Preserve.
One day, if you've been climbing all your life, you're going to get to your last climb.
I thought the trip was over, but Doug and Yvonne showed me this unclimbed peak on the edge of the new park that they tried to climb last year. They want to give it one more shot, and they've asked me to come along.
Text on screen, Cerro Geyser, day 164. Three men set out on an adventure. They hike across a ridge overlooking a blue tarn formed in the hollow of a mountainside. They trudge across an ice field. At sunset, they set up base camp and have a picnic dinner. Jeff asks Ivan,
"What do you want to call the route?"
"Nothing. Just climb it. Walk away. Doesn't matter anymore."
Doug gazes at Ivan. In a flashback of archival footage, younger Ivan and Doug laugh during the attack on Fitzroy.
Each of us in our own way got to do something. Save your soul, you know. Whatever that is.
By feet high on the shoulder of Geyser, the climbers watch a sky show of clouds that swirl and drift above the majestic peaks. At dawn, Ivan unzips his one-person bag tent. Doug fixes climbing crampons to his shoes.
Here's to now. Here's to now.
They set out in a thick white fog.
actually was thinking. Said everything out loud, cause apricot seeds carry arsenal that we don't worry about. Sitting on your doorstep waiting for you to come home or come out. Well, apple seeds have cyanide that we don't care about. So here's for now.
They climb the steep rock.
Here's to now.
Text on screen. Doug and Chris Tompkins continue to live and work in Patagonia full-time on Conservación Patagónica.
Up in every town, as the beans get aged and the bellies get sagged, well, the people fall right.
Ivan and his wife Melinda support hundreds of grassroots conservation groups around the world.
I'm not proud of.
When Ivan isn't surfing or fly fishing,
the bellies get sagged, well, their instincts are fall out. Here's for now.
The sun shines through the summit, illuminating the three climbers traversing the last 24 feet of rocky slabs.
Here's to now. Here's to now.
Jeff Johnson is compiling his photographs and journals for a book about his journey to Patagonia.
When he drinks, he talks too much.
He's planning a return trip to give Corcovado another shot.
Well, I can see he's a little bit touched. Actually, was thinking, said everything out loud, cause Epcot's.
Ivan makes the summit of Geyser.
We don't care about.
The Baker River Dam construction is scheduled to begin in 2013 along with several more pulp mills along the coast. The Gauchos plan to ride on the capital again this year.
Here's to now.
Doug and Jeff join Ivan on the top of the mountain. All three sit on the rocky peak and take a look around. A glacial expanse stretches beneath the summit. A hawk soars across the blue sky. Jeff puts on his backpack in preparation to descend. Text on screen, the end. Get involved. For more information, visit sinrepresas.com, conservationpatagonica.org. Directed by Chris Malloy. Produced by Dim Lanch. Produced by Rick Ridgeway. Produced by Amit Malloy. Executive producer, Rick Ridgeway. Executive producers, Dan Emmett, Liesl Copeland, Ted Sarandos, Tom Zadra. Executive producer, D.V. DeVincentis. Director of photography, Danny Mutter. Journals by, Jeff Johnson. Story by, Chris Malloy, Rick Ridgeway, Zachary Slobig, Stephen Barilotti. Animation and artwork, Jeff McFetteridge. Original music, Ugly Casanova. Isaac Brock, Eric Judy, Tom Peloso, Joe Plummer, Clay Jones, Shoko Yotsin Moraza. Starring, Yvonne Chouinard, Douglas Tompkins, Jeff Johnson, Keith Malloy, Alicia Salome Akanya Ikamakoa, Timmy O'Neill. Edited by Tim Wheeler. Additional credits roll on the screen.